First on today's MOA, Laurie Mercier interviews Jesse Walker, who wrote the book Rebels on the Air, An Alternative History of Radio.
And with me is Jesse Walker, author of Rebels on the Air. Welcome to KABU, Jesse.
Glad to be here.
Let me introduce you, Jesse, first. Jesse Walker is the managing editor of Reason Magazine and Reason.com. He is a former DJ and has written on topics ranging from pirate radio to copyright law for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Z, and numerous other publications. And today on The Old Mole, we're focusing on the old and new media and want to talk with him about his book, Rebels on the Air, An Alternative History of Radio in America, which traces the origins of community radio and the government and corporate roadblocks that have attempted to limit its reach. And Jesse, in your book, you describe an enormous creativity and experimentation in the 1960s and early 1970s when community radio activists, including Lewis Hill, who helped launch KPFA FM in Berkeley, and the Pacifica Foundation, which would go on to establish stations across the country, and Lorenzo Milam, the Johnny Appleseed of community radio, who had a hand in starting Crab FM in Seattle and our own KABU here in Portland. What happened to make these experiments in community radio more difficult?
Radio, and I should say Lewis Hill was a little bit earlier than Lorenzo Milam, but he was sort of a granddaddy of it because Lorenzo Milam worked for Lou Hill's station in Berkeley, and that helped inspire him to create CRAB, or K-R-A-B, in Seattle. But what really changed is, it's not the only time there's this burst of experimentation, and it might help just to compare it to what happened in the 50s, because in the 50s, when TV came along and all the sorts of programmings people had on the radio migrated to TV, sitcoms and the stuff that was just dominating mainstream radio, people suddenly had all this space and they were losing listeners and they were forced to experiment. And then when FM opened up in the 60s, and it had technically been existing earlier, but the FCC had restricted it and had actually moved it from one part of the dial to another one part of the spectrum to another, making everyone's radios useless. So they had done a lot of things just to hobble the growth of FM to protect the people on AM from competition, mostly. Is that it was this big space that mostly people weren't doing anything with, and that allowed people to experiment. And this happened to coincide with the ferment of the 60s, so a lot of people had ideas for how they wanted to experiment. And you had, community radio taking off. Then you also had on the commercial band people experimenting with freeform. It's hard to imagine a commercial freeform station in most markets today, but that actually for a few years was kind of a common, as some big companies that had no idea how to appeal to countercultural listeners and decided just to hire a bunch of people, in some cases people from community radio, to do their programming for them.
Because the independent creative radio was sort of pushing commercial radio in that direction, right?
Yeah, the idea was, we don't know what to do, we might as well let these guys play. And then once they found, hey, they can make a lot of money with FM, they started bringing in more controls over what the stations could do there. So on the one hand, you have these new controls coming on within the stations. The other problem was that the band was filling up. And this is what keeps ending these periods of experimentations, is that you keep eventually running up against the barriers of how much space there is for people to communicate. The problem is there's much more space than the government allows people to use. You could have many, many more radio stations on the FM dial right now without causing significant interference than you have right now. But the people who currently possess the radio stations that are there now, who own the licenses, do not want to deal with the competition for listeners, and they don't want to deal with the competition for advertisers, although I would argue that with that much room, you would have a bias towards non-commercial and even amateur stations. So that's the larger problem, is that the FCC doesn't allow all the people who could go on the air to go on the air. And that's why we saw the micro-radio movement in the 90s. A lot of people said, well, if we can't get licenses, we're going to go on the air anyway and broadcast and invite the FCC to bust us and have essentially a movement for civil disobedience to have more free speech on the airwaves.
Now, this movement to restrict the airwaves began in the mid-1970s?
It's existed. It has existed for as long as there have been government regulations of the airwaves. I mean, it's always been regulated on behalf of the people who are the dominant players in the industry. So you could go back to the founding of the FCC, actually before the founding of the FCC in the 1930s. When the Federal Radio Commission was created in the late 1920s, the first order of business was deciding, well, how are we going to divvy up the airwaves? And they made a conscious decision. And I know you're going to have Robert McChesney on the show this hour. He talks about this a lot in his first book, that they were going to prefer what they called general interest stations over what they called propaganda stations. And propaganda station meant anything done from a particular point of view. So if a station was run by a union, by a church, by a nonprofit, they were discriminated against. If you had a broad-based network station, you know, like CBS and NBC affiliate, then that was going to be the beneficiary. When FM came along, a similar procedure happened with, AM powers that be, you know, making sure their friends at the FCC made things difficult for FM. In particular, RCA was trying to control the patents for FM and didn't have it, and there was a revolving door that worked to RCA's benefit. So so what happened in the 1970s was simply that they found that FM could be profitable. They found that long-haired kids listening to rock music were a market to be served, so people started investing more in FM. And a lot of these stations were already owned by big companies that were less averse to experimentation once they had figured out a formula that they thought worked. But they didn't have that extra space for the independent people to go on and keep experimenting, or they didn't have nearly enough space because of all these enclosures and barriers that had already been put in place in the law long before then.
Now, Jesse, you also write about how many radio activists sought government funding, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and National Public Radio were created then. But then how did the conditions of funding affect the nature of independent radio?
Oh, in all sorts of ways. I mean, they come with strings attached. And director of KABU was one of the people who protested the first bunch of strings that were attached when the Corporation for Public Broadcasting started distributing the money. The nature of the strings has varied over the years, but they often involve having a certain amount of professional staff, reaching a certain number of listeners according to the ratings that are used by commercial stations, which is not the only way to measure audiences. And in general, it frequently set up a treadmill so that stations would, in order to get government money, would have to spend a lot of money in order to hire that extra staff and professionalize, and that in turn made them dependent on the money that they were receiving from the government. And then they would say, well, we're changing our rules for how you're going to give out the money. We're going to have a healthy station project that encourages you to professionalize more. Perhaps get away from having all these different kinds of shows that don't mix well together. We want to have just one streamlined sort of programming throughout the day. And a lot of stations, as a result, in community radio, went through pitched battles over how they were going to structure themselves, what the nature of the station would be, what the soul of the station would be.
Well, you mentioned micro radio as a movement in the 1990s. I mean, what have been some of the bright spots or models in terms of independent radio in the past decade?
In the 90s or in the last decade?
Well, in the last decade, since the 90s. And where do you think we're headed in terms of experimental and independent radio?
Well, I have to say the most exciting stuff is happening online right now because, again, that's the space where people can experiment, and that's also a space that the FCC, they have regulations on certain levels of what goes on with telecommunications industry, but in terms of content, there aren't any FCC controls. What they have, the main part of the government they have to worry about is the Copyright Office, actually. And so as a result, you've seen this explosion of creativity online. Now, there are ways that the Internet is very different from AM and FM broadcasting. Lots of Internet radio is not localized. You can have localized Internet radio. There's a lot of localized stuff that happens online. But more of what's really you know, useful and different on the internet is in terms of either someone playing sorts of music in an intense niche that you can't find elsewhere, or you know, doing freeform, which often you can't find you know, on the radio dial except in places like community radio and college radio. A lot of podcasts are interesting talk shows, but and then they often will get picked up in different radio stations around the country, but they tend to be more nationally or globally focused if people put them on as podcasts. Again, there are exceptions. So the bright spot is this immense amount of diversity and experimentation online, and the fact that you're able to see, new things you can't do with the old radio medium, and, you know, the flexibility, listening when you want to, and so on. But the downside is you can't do a call-in podcast, you know. So much of it is not locally based. There's a lot of stuff that's still very good for a traditional AM or FM station to do. And my hope is that at the same time that we see this, thousand flowers blooming online, we'll still be able to keep the KBOO type stations doing their creative broadcasting.
So community radio then does not necessarily need to see this internet, the flourishing of internet activity as competition, but maybe as opportunity.
Oh, it absolutely is opportunity. I mean, I'm not sure if this is true of KBOO, but I know many stations simulcast, online and have listeners in elsewhere, keeping track of what's happening in their old hometowns. You have people getting programming from online, putting, exchange. It used to be in the early 70s when community radio stations were just sprouting up all over the country. They would do what they called bicycling, which was basically meant mailing tapes from one to another so they can play them, a week later on another station. Now you can put something online and a whole bunch of stations can play it or play part of it whenever they want to. And that's a wonderful tool.
Right.
I'm certainly not in any way anti-internet.
Well, thanks, Jesse Walker. This is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour. And speaking of the internet, the Old Mole has a podcast and also a website with links to the interviewees of the day with Jesse Walker and a link to his book, Rebels on the Air, An Alternative History of Radio in America. And Jesse, we're raising money today to support independent community-powered KBOO. Could you tell us why it's important to support stations like KBOO?
I would say that if you listen to and enjoy a radio station that derives its support primarily from listeners, it's wise to, and you can afford to, then it's wise to become one of the listeners who supports such a station. It's not a model where you're dependent on underwriting. It's not a model where you're depending on advertising. It's not a model where you're dependent on government subsidies. It's a model where, the person who pays the bills in the driver's seat. And if you want to be in that driver's seat, if you want the listeners to be in the driver's seat, then it's good to support the listener support model.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Jesse Walker.